Kia ora, hello and welcome to this weather training teleclass lecture. This is the first of the South Pacific teleclass series for 2013, so welcome. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's speaker who is talking to us from Tauranga in the North Island of New Zealand. Dr. Massimo Giola originates from Italy, where he graduated in medicine and went on to obtain a research doctorate in 2008 in clinical and experimental pharmacology. He then worked in infectious diseases between 1993 and 2009 at Varese Regional Hospital in Italy, when he moved to New Zealand to take a consultant infectious disease position in Southland in Cardinal. He continues to work in the specialist field in Tauranga Hospital, where he maintains his interest in infection prevention and control, as well as research interests in antiviral drug treatment. Having heard Massimo talk at the 2012 New Zealand conference on this topic, which is relevant to so many of us in infection prevention, I know that you'll enjoy his presentation. Welcome, Massimo, and thank you very much for being our guest speaker today.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction, and good afternoon to everyone. Well, anyway, it's afternoon here in New Zealand, so whatever it is where you are, I understand all of you should have my presentation in front of you on your computer as I speak, and I will assist indicating when we turn to the next slide. Okay? So the topic I was given for this talk was the ideal hospital. Okay? But I have going to slide two to say that, first of all, I have no particular conflict of interest. I'm not an architect. I don't design or build new hospitals. And second, the contents of this presentation reflect my opinions only. Okay, and sometimes they can be quite personal opinions. So I'm definitely aware of that. If we go to the third slide, of course, since I moved to New Zealand, people have been asking me pretty much on a constant basis, why have you left Italy, such a beautiful country, to come to New Zealand? And I was a bit embarrassed at first, and I looked for answers like, you know, wanting a change in perspective, a change of career, other personal circumstances and so on, but I think now I've got the right answer. Okay, some of you might know who Sir John Kirwan is. He's apparently a rugby coach, and being rugby the national religion basically in New Zealand, everyone seems to know about him. I didn't, but I came across last year to this interview, 12 extra questions with Sir John Kirwan, and at the end of the interview, the journalist asked him, what does New Zealand need more of? And John Kirwan, who's been coaching rugby teams in Europe and specifically in Italy for a while, and he actually married an Italian woman, said, I think we're in a good place from a multicultural point of view. We probably need more Europeans and specifically more Italians. So coming to the next slide, I think I've got the answer now. I'm here to help, okay, to give a bit of creativity and Italian flavor to New Zealand, really, as my new adoptive country. Talking about Italy and going to slide number six, you've got here a very famous painting, which is currently and will always be there since it's a fresco in the Vatican City, in the private Pope's apartments. Okay, and this is a painting, if you go to the next slide, by Raphael, the School of Athens, or the School of Philosophers, okay, where Raphael put in the same room all the main Greek philosophers, even if they lived hundreds of years and hundreds of kilometers apart. Raphael imagines to put them all together in the same room. And in the center of the painting, there are two main characters. who are supposed to be Plato on the left and Aristotle on the right. Okay, and you can see how these two central figures have gestures along different dimensions. Plato vertically, pointing the finger to the beautiful vault above, whereas Aristotle has an horizontal sort of movement with his right hand showing the ground, the floor beneath. Okay, so it's popularly thought that Raphael wanted to symbolize and to indicate the central aspects of their philosophies. For Plato, his theory of forms, idea, and for Aristotle, his empiricist views with an emphasis on the concrete details and the nitty-gritty of day-by-day problems. So what I tried to do with this presentation in Rotorua, and I'm trying to replicate today, is to be your Plato, basically, to show you what the ideal form of the new hospital should be. So this lecture will not go much into details, but will mainly embrace an ideal and visionary way of speaking about the ideal hospital, if that makes sense. If we go to the following slide, we are fast forward 350 years from Raphael, okay? And this gentleman is not actually a famous microbiologist. He's not Pasteur or Koch or, you know, Jenner or anything like that. He's, going to the following slide, Jules Verne, which was a friend, who was a French author and one of the pioneers of science fiction, okay? Most of his books are really worldwide famous, like Journey to the Center of the Earth, Around the World in 80 Days, and so on. But going to the following slide, he wrote sort of 100 novels plus many more short novels and tales. And one of his less known works, but actually quite interesting, is The Begum's Fortune in the English translation, or Les 500 Millions de la Begum in the original French, okay? And basically the history that Verne tells in this novel is that this incredibly high fortune was split into two equal parts between the two heirs of an Indian begum, a French doctor, specialist in public health and hygiene, and a German engineer. Okay, and with their share of the begum's fortune, they both go to the U.S. to establish the ideal city, the French doctor, and the ideal factory, the German engineer. And as always, things go in novels, things go custard pretty soon, and war, follows between the French and the Germans, and the French being Verne. French, of course, win at the end of the book, but that's not the point. The point, if you go to the following slide, number 11, is that Verne gives us a very nice description of the ideal city for the 19th century philosopher and scientist and passionate about the future, okay, like he was. And among the description of the ideal city as houses, streets, and other things go, he also describes the ideal hospital. And it's quite interesting to note how many of Verne's specifications for the ideal hospital still apply to my presentation today. First of all, the city established by the French doctor is called Franceville, of course. And in Franceville, the hospital, as we know it today, is actually the exception, and hospital in the home is the rule, which is still a very modern concept today and was totally revolutionary in 19th century, the idea that most patients could be actually looked after and followed up in the community rather than coming to the hospital. When they do need to come to the hospital, Verne says that the ideal hospital should be small and have no more than 20, 30 beds per ward, okay? And all the beds will be in single room with ensuite, which is still controversial today, and it was sort of an established truth for Verne, which is very interesting. And he goes even farther than that to a concept that we are only starting to imagine today, such as the totally disposable hospital, the totally disposable room. And his hospital is made of pine wood cabins, which are built to be destroyed, to be incinerated at the very least every year or more often if required. Okay. Even in the houses, he says there should be no carpet, no wallpaper, no fabric curtains, nothing that can possibly harbor dust, microorganisms, fomites of infection, which is a very modern idea even now. So starting from there and going to the following slide and going backwards again in time, we see how the evolution from the Middle Age hospital, this is Paris, the Hôtel Dieu hospital in 1500, basically the only thing that people could do regarding infection control was sewing up the body bags as soon as people died to avoid infectious diseases like plague spreading around the hospital. And you can see how people were two in the same bed. So infection control was really in a very, very primitive state at that stage. Then we follow with the Italian Renaissance. There are still beautiful Renaissance hospitals around Italy, like in Florence, Ospedale degli Innocenti, or in Pistoia, another beautiful town in Tuscany, the Ospedale del Ceppo. They are beautiful buildings from an architectural point of view. And, for example, the Ospedale degli Innocenti in Florence was actually used like a pediatric hospital until the first half of the 20th century. Luckily, they're all museums now, and none of them is used as a hospital anymore. Going to slide number 14, well, why do we need to change our mind regarding infection prevention and control? What was the big paradigm shift over the last decade? Well, since we are infection specialists, we should always go back to the basics and think that it's the bugs, okay? As it was said in an American presidential election, it's the economy, stupid. So as long as the economy goes well, the president will always be reelected. In infection control, we should always think to bugs. It's the bugs, stupid. That should be what we tell to, you know, ourselves. So what has changed? Well, until reasonably recently, the main problem in infection control was MRSA. And for MRSA, traditional contact isolation and hand washing was thought to be enough, maybe, to prevent the spread of infection across patients in the hospital. This is definitely different now, going to slide 15. We live now in the era of new multiple bugs affecting hospital patients. Viruses like norovirus and others, fungi, Aspergillus and so on, waterborne diseases, Legionella, atypical mycobacteria, spore-forming organisms like Clostridium, vancomycin-resistant enterococci, multidrug-resistant gram-negative organisms like multidrug-resistant Pseudomonas, extensively drug-resistant Acinetobacter, carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. If you just think about it, most of these organisms share a way of transmission which is less dependent on direct person-to-person contact and more dependent on sharing the same environment, especially the same toilet and the same room and the same, you know, sort of more general environment. Going to slide 16, we therefore need new strategies and new weapons. So the pendulum, which was almost to the extreme of hand washing is the only thing that matters in infection control, is now swinging back to, yes, hand washing is still the first and the most important, probably single thing we can do, but it's not enough. We also need to implement enhanced cleaning and environmental control. And in particular, I think we should have one mantra that we repeat to ourselves every day, morning and evening, which is one bum, one toilet, okay? Which means basically having people not sharing the same toilet, which is very, very important in the hospital context. And this is challenging for infection prevention and control professionals, but it also means that infection prevention and control professionals must be back to the table where the big decisions are made and the big money is spent, like planning, designing, and building new healthcare facilities. Okay, so that's where we should be nowadays. So the first main point of my presentation, and it took 17 slides to arrive to this point, but I think it was worthwhile, the effort. The ideal hospital of the 21st century has a bed-to-toilet ratio of 1, which means every patient must have a single room with ensuite. Okay, and there are multiple examples around the world now of brand new hospitals built with 100% single rooms with ensuite. I've just picked up a few examples from the internet. You're more than welcome to look for more, and I'm sure there are many more examples around. But, you know, you can Google St. Olaf's Hospital in Trondheim, Norway, Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam, Belgium, the new Fiona Stanley Hospital in Perth, the new Royal Adelaide Hospital, and you can have a look at the plans, and you can have a look at the documents that have been put online and make up your own mind about that. Even in the most conservative settings nowadays, new hospitals have at least 50% single, 50% double rooms, all of them with ensuite, of course. Going to next slide, what are the advantages of the single room? I told you at the start of the presentation that I was not going to give you details, so I'm just going to give you some hints. You've got the references, and you can go and, again, read the articles. This paper was published reasonably recently in the American Journal of Infection Control, and I thoroughly recommend for any infection prevention and control specialist to read it very, very carefully. The link of the single room to many advantages are, you know, thoroughly explained. The single room is strongly linked to reduced hospital-acquired infections, improved patient sleep, improved patient privacy, improved communication with the care team, and increased overall patient satisfaction. Going to slide 19, from the same paper again, the single room is less strongly, but still significantly linked to reduced medical errors, reduced patient stress, improved social support, decreased staff stress, increased staff effectiveness, increased staff satisfaction. Some of these things are quite surprising, really. Some of the medical errors which were reduced by the single room are actually medication errors. We all know how things can happen, you know. Just give some paracetamol to the wee old lady with the bed in the corner, and you go into the room and all the beds in the corner, quite unsurprisingly, have a wee old lady in the bed. So, you know, medication errors can happen this way, whereas if every patient has a single room, and that is clearly identified, medication errors seem to be much less likely. If we go to slide number 20, some countries have published detailed building guidelines reasonably recently, summarizing all the evidence regarding single rooms versus multi-bedroom. One of those countries is Ireland, where they published infection prevention and control building guidelines in 2008 and have copied and pasted this table from the published guidelines. You can see how the single occupancy room scores favorably against the multiple occupancy room in basically all the variables they have considered, okay, which are related to infection prevention and control, but not only to infection prevention and control. When I started talking with people regarding single room, I was quite surprised that most of the resistances came from the nursing staff, and I tried to understand why, and I was told, oh, you know, putting people in a single room will increase their risk of falling and lying on the floors forever because no one is there and no one can notice that. Well, of course, if you put people in a single room at the end of a 50-meter corridor and no one is checking on them, then you can have increased risk of falls. But when you take the right provisions, like reshaping the ward so that the shape is a compact triangular or polygonal shape, and there is a nursing station just outside the rooms, every 2 to 3 rooms, and provisions are taken for the nurses to be able to spend all their time in those peripheral nursing desks rather than in a central nursing room, you know, many meters away from the actual patient's room, then falls are actually decreased. And there are many smart technology methods and tools now available to monitor a patient in a single room remotely, like, you know, falls alarms or webcams or whatever. And if you go to slide number 21, this is how the building guidelines in Ireland shape the ideal ward 100% single beds. Okay, so that's why it's actually impossible to convert an existing hospital from multi-bedrooms to single rooms. You really have to apply these guidelines to new hospitals and new wards. Okay. Another important thing is that people should be able to see from the outside what's happening inside the room. So that's why you should always have a large observation window beside the door so that people can see what's happening inside. If the patients inside are alert, vigilant, don't need supervision, you can have blinds to ensure privacy. But if you have a non-cooperative, confused patient, you definitely want to be able to see what's happening into the room all the time. And going to number 22, this is how the single room in Erasmus Medical Center in Rotterdam looks like. No carpet anywhere to be seen. State-of-the-art technology, wide, bright windows, plenty of natural light. This is how an ideal room should look like. And if you go to the next slide, this is probably taking things a bit too far. This is how the French imagine the la chambre d'hôpital du futur, the room, the hospital room of the future, how it was presented in Lille in 2012. So you don't even have a bed anymore. It's a sort of a business class reclining seat, the idea being that you can encourage mobility and early discharge by, you know, progressing towards standing up rather than lying down all the time. And you notice also the big screen on the wall so people can actually have access to the electronic medical records of the patient, blood tests, imaging studies right in the room while doing the ward round. So that's possibly pushing things a bit too far, but I'm pretty sure at some stage in the future, hospital rooms will look, if not exactly like that, at least, you know, in some ways, a bit like that. Another example in the following slide is the new layout of the rooms in Montreal, Canada, and in the Children's Hospital. So again, you see how the layout of the ward has been modified to a sort of quadrangular shape with nursing stations in the middle and in the periphery, and the rooms along at the outside of the square, basically. And again, you can see how you have door and a wide window, observation window beside it, in order to be able to keep an eye on what's happening inside. Next slide, number 25. We have here an artist or a photo impression of how Fiona Stanley Hospital was looking at the time I presented this talk in Rotorua in August. I'm pretty sure things will be much more advanced right now. And on the right side, you have the layout of the wards in the new Royal Adelaide Hospital. So again, you can see how the ward has a sort of a triangular shape with nursing stations in the middle and the rooms on the periphery, each one of them being single bed with ensuite. Following slide, number 26, I'm trying here to summarize pretty much what's the approach to the single rooms around the world, in or at least in different countries. France, historically, has always had a very high percentage of single bedrooms, approaching 100%. Probably they all read Verne. In the U.S., over the last few years, possibly decades, there is an almost universal switch to 100% single rooms, and that's not only for infection control purposes, but also to improve patient satisfaction in a context of highly competitive healthcare providers trying to lure patients to one hospital rather than the other. Whereas in Germany, for example, for some reason Germans love to have a roommate when they are in the hospital. So the prevailing model is the double room with ensuite. Going to next slide. In the Scandinavian countries, again, pretty much the standard is 50% single, 50% doubles. In some country like Norway, some new hospitals are being built with 100% single. In the Netherlands, again, the trend is 50% single, 50% double. Slide number 28. In Ireland, it's currently planned that all new hospitals will have 50% single room with ensuite. Switzerland has been building new hospitals from the 90s now onwards, all of them with 50% single, 50% double. And even in the UK, traditionally quite a conservative country when it comes to healthcare planning and new buildings, there is a progressive trend towards higher percentages of single rooms, okay, averaging probably around 50% single, 50% double. Even in Italy, the hospital I used to work in before coming to New Zealand, Varese Regional Hospital, which was designed and built in the 90s, is 50% single, 50% double rooms, all with ensuite. Okay, so it's possible. It's not financially too onerous. It requires a bit of an investment initially, but then you are repaid along the way with less infections and better occupation of your rooms and avoiding constantly moving patients around the hospital to follow transient isolation needs is also quite important from a financial and administrative point of view. If you go to slide 30, I'm really hoping that we can achieve this in New Zealand as well. Okay, and the new Christchurch Hospital will be a big opportunity to have the first single room only, or at least 50% single, 50% double room only hospital, and I'm really looking forward to it. When I started working here in the Bay of Plenty in the North Island, we were building a new hospital in Whakatane, which is a smaller town around 100 of kilometers away from Tauranga, which is the main center in the Bay of Plenty. But unfortunately, the plans were already made. It was too late to modify them. So we are building right now a brand new hospital, unfortunately still with a large proportion of multi-bedded rooms. So out of 79 beds, we'll have only 21 single rooms and only 3 doubles, the rest of them being 3-bedded or 4-bedded rooms. But I guess it's too late now. Going to the next slide, the single room is very important, in my opinion. It's, of course, it's not the only one. There are other intelligent features of the ideal hospital that no architect would consider unless you show them and you talk them through. Okay, so being a good architect does not necessarily mean you know everything about infection control. You really need an expert talking you through. And that's why you, my audience today, infection prevention and control specialists, really can have a big impact. We had this experience here in the brand new hospital we are building in Whakatane. The architects didn't put any hand washing basins in the corridors. And we knew from the main hospital in Tauranga, talking with staff, that hand washing basins in the corridors were highly appreciated and considered to be very, very useful for staff. So we insisted and managed to get some hand washing basins in the corridors. Another thing the architects didn't think of was putting some sliding doors midway down the long corridor. So in case of an outbreak, you could actually close these doors and effectively separate a bigger ward in two separate cohorting facilities. Having a physical separation, it's really important because it gives to staff, public, patients themselves a clear sense that something is going on, there's an outbreak, and you need to be more careful, check in, wash your hands, don your gowns or whatever before crossing those doors. Otherwise, people just don't notice. People just don't look at signs on the walls. They just walk in, and when you stop them, they are always, you know, too far into cohorting, supposedly isolation facility. Okay, going to slide 32. I'm now, you know, switching to more behavioral aspects of the ideal hospital rather than structural aspects. So one important thing is that the ideal hospital, in my opinion, and according to the most recent literature, should have really 5 categories of isolation, not 4. The 4 traditional ones that we all know are airborne, droplet, contact, and protective. But actually, there is an increasing body of evidence in the literature suggesting that we should have 5 isolation categories. The 5th one being, if you go to the next slide, so-called contact plus isolation. That should be used instead of contact only for highly contagious diarrhea, And by highly contagious diarrhea, especially in a hospital setting, we normally mean norovirus and C. diff. Okay, so in contact plus, we should apply the contact precautions plus shut the door, wear full protective equipment, gown and gloves. I never mention aprons because I think aprons are for dishwashing, not really for protecting yourself, since you are supposed to use your hands and arms normally. So you do need a long-sleeved gown, in my opinion, as a protective equipment. So gown, gloves for direct contact, and washing hands with soap and water rather than alcohol-based gel when you after your contact or your procedure or your contact with patient surroundings, because it has been shown that soap and water remove more effectively than alcohol-based gel norovirus infective particles or C. diff spores. Slide 34. Another thing that's very dear to my heart is that in the ideal hospital, the real VIPs, very important persons, are the cleaners. Okay, I always say that cleaners are actually more important than managers in the hospital. And sadly, the importance of the hospital cleaners steadily degraded over the past 15 to 20 years. They are outsourced, understaffed, underpaid, undervalued. They are treated as the last of the last, which is definitely not good enough, because we know that cleaning is important. It's very hard to demonstrate the evidence of it, but we have published studies that show that insufficient cleaning is associated with increased rates of MRSA, gram-negative multi-resistant organisms, VRE, C. diff, and other spore-forming pathogens. And we do know that increased cleaning, we don't know exactly why, but we do know that increased cleaning, together with a bundle of other precautions and implementations, is effective in reducing the transmission of these pathogens. If you go to the next slide, I'm old enough to remember when hospitals used to smell of bleach. Okay, then bleach went out of fashion and was basically abandoned. Some people think that at least in some circumstances, like if we have an outbreak of VRE and spore-forming organisms, norovirus, we should actually implement bleach-based cleaning. And there is an increasing body of evidence that non-touch methods are actually required for terminal cleaning, like either hydrogen peroxide vapors or UV light. It is, again, it requires some money, some investments. It definitely requires having enough time, but it's effective. I had a presentation with the clinical nurse leaders in my hospital, and there was a unanimous complaining from the clinical nurse leaders that in order to meet the expected efficiency targets, people are rushed through from ED to the wards without giving enough time for terminal cleaning. Okay, I'm not sure about other countries, but we do have performance targets here in New Zealand, and one of the performance targets is that 95% of patients presenting to ED should be sorted in some way within 6 hours. And sadly, those targets, which are really output measures, not outcome measures, are not audited against outcomes regarding infection control. So as long as we rush patients through, everything's okay, even if they go into a room where someone with C. diff was until a few hours earlier, and the room was actually cleaned in a hurry to make sure that the target was met. That's quite sad and shouldn't happen, really. If you go to slide number 36, that's just a few recent articles, you know, demonstrating what I was talking about. And again, I'm not providing too many details. You can do your own research. You're more than welcome to go and check these articles and tell me I'm wrong if that's the case. I always like good discussion, even if it's controversial, being from Italy, especially if it's controversial, actually. If you go to number 37, going back to the cleaners again, I feel sorry for our cleaners, really, because it looks like we are trying to make their life as hard as possible. I constantly see hospital wards which are cluttered, full of trolleys, other things that are impossible to effectively clean. So we should make every effort, really, to make the hospital easy to clean, which means one system, one finishing style, no carpet anywhere. It's totally crazy having carpet in an office and in the rest of the ward vinyl, which means that cleaners have to use two different methods, or, as it actually happens in practice, not cleaning at all the carpeted part because there's no time enough. Okay, so the idea is that the hospital should be really totally washable. No carpet, no soft fabric furniture, no nooks and crannies, no cluttered corridors, a place for everything and everything in its place. Slide 38, this is the hematology and bone marrow transplant unit in Zurich. And that is how, ideally, a hospital ward should look like. Nothing around, just a few trolleys that can be easily moved whenever it's time to clean, okay? 39, slide 39, there are very, very interesting projects around. I found this one from the UK, which is called Design Bugs Out. And basically the concept is that hospital furniture should be easy to clean and resistant to cleaning implements as much as possible. And I actually think they are also, you know, good-looking furniture items, not just easy to clean, which is the main idea. Slide number 40, another thing that's very dear to my heart, how we dress when we work in the hospital. And that's mostly because I had a bit of a cultural shock when I came from Italy to New Zealand, because on my first day in Invercargill Hospital, I had orientation. And at the end of orientation, I thought, oh, this is all very nice. I'm very happy with everything. Now, where can I get my uniforms from? And they gave me the blank stare and told me, oh, we really don't have uniforms for doctor. You can come to work as you are now in your street clothes. And I was, oh, really? Is this how people dress in the hospitals in this part of the world? And the answer was yes. So I was quite surprised that, you know, there was no one, no doctors were wearing scrubs, or the more old-fashioned one would wear white coats, but actually scrubs would be the norm in most parts of the world, and for sure in continental Europe. Now, there has been a bit of a recent interest regarding nursing and physician attire as possible source of nosocomial infections. We know that potentially pathogenic bacteria like Acinetobacter, Pseudomonas, Staph aureus, drug-resistant Enterobacteriaceae can actually be found in uniforms. This paper was published in the American Journal of Infection Control in 2011, and the study was done in Israel, if I remember correctly. More than welcome to go and check and tell me I was wrong. And in 63% of the sampled uniforms, they actually found bacteria and antibiotic-resistant bacteria from 14% of uniforms for nurses and 6% of uniforms for physicians. And if we go to number 41, the point is really not what we are wearing. Probably anything we are wearing is fine as long as we change and wash everything daily, and no one else in the world except UK and France or former colonies actually wears street clothes in the hospital. And personally, I'm always told, well, if we all wear scrubs, then patients don't know who's a doctor, who's a nurse, who's in charge. We can have color-coded scrubs, so, you know, patients will know instantly if they are speaking with a doctor or with a nurse or with someone else. So there are ways around these problems, really. If you go to slide number 42, they even did studies looking at what patients think about how doctors are dressed, okay, being shown photos of male doctors and female doctors wearing different attires, ranging from scrubs to the white coat to formal, informal, semi-formal, and casual attire. And quite surprisingly, if you go to slide 43, patients don't care, really. So that's a Likert confidence scale, where above 3, basically, it means that it's fine, and below 3, it's not. So you can see how every attire is actually above 3, apart from casual, which was really casual. If you go back, it was like T-shirt and jeans, okay? So everything else is fine. There's no difference. People are happy with doctors wearing scrubs. It's not a problem. This is actually a New Zealand study, so that's why I showed it. If you go to slide 44 in Rotorua, and again, they confronted patients with photos of doctors wearing different attire. And going to slide 45, quite interestingly, male doctor or female doctor smiling were most preferred by patients regardless of the attire. So it looks like a smile, at least in New Zealand, goes a long way, far more than wearing a formal or an informal attire, really. If you go to slide 46, let's just avoid going to the extreme, okay? So that was shortly after Prince Harry of England was seen in a state of undress in public, and it looked like at that stage the English, and especially the royal family, were pushing things a bit too far. So we just wanted to make sure in Rotorua that no one was taking the bare below the elbow policy too far, really. And last but not least, going to slide 47, thank you to you all for your attention. And yeah, the ideal hospital doesn't need to be boring-looking place. It can be a wonderful place to work in and to be admitted in as a patient. This is a brand new hospital in Mestre, in northeastern Italy, near to Venice, and it's a stunning architectural building, despite being built to the latest specifications of infection prevention and control. So I'm really looking forward to see a similarly stunning building in Christchurch over the next few years. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Massimo. We too are really looking forward to that wonderful new hospital, though we're still very much at the concept planning stage down here. I can't open the lines for questions from the audience externally, but I'm very happy if people do have questions for Massimo. I can certainly forward those on, just use my email address, which is on your slides or on the Weber Training website. Just a quick comment or question for you, really, Massimo. Do you think our guidelines are keeping pace with the changes that you described in terms of hospital design and layout and the single room ratio? Because it's becoming quite difficult as IP&C staff to really convince managers that outlay in capital is worth the benefits that you've described?
Sure. Well, I guess we don't start from scratch. So there are definitely overseas experiences that we can bring forward to support, basically, our request. And if the whole world is going that direction, well, they cannot be all wrong, really. And if the whole world is choosing to invest some more money when a hospital is being built to actually save money later down the track, there must be some good evidence around. So again, I couldn't do a full sort of cost-benefit analysis, but I'm pretty sure this can be found somewhere, probably in the U.S., where they are obviously very, very, conscious of the money and what goes behind it, really. So, yeah. Some patient satisfaction surveys maybe might help as well.
Yes, that's right. I think all too often we forget to actually ask the patient what they would like out of their hospitals when they have to visit. So, yeah. Okay, thank you very much for that. I could talk to you for much longer on this topic because it's, as we've said, something very close to many of our hearts down here. But as I say, I really hope that we end up with a fantastic hospital like some of the ones that you've described. So in closing this afternoon, I'd like to once again thank Massimo very much for his contribution to this series on what is really a very critical area of infection prevention and control. Our next South Pacific teleclass is on April the 17th, when we'll be joined by Professor Tom Riley from Western Australia, who will be updating us on the topic of Clostridium difficile infection. So I'm looking forward to that because I know he's got some good new information for us on that topic. So you can register for these or any of the other classes in 2013 via the Weber Training website, many of which you'll find listed on your final slide of today's presentation. So thank you very much for joining us today. Until next time, from all of us here in New Zealand, thank you and goodbye.